is the Grillion Report. The unusual, weird news, anomalies, exopolitics. It's Beyond the Fringe, where conspiracy theory can become conspiracy fact. This is the Grillion Report with your host, Micah Hanks.
From hundreds of miles beneath terra firma in the depths of the hollow earth, live from the Grillion Bunker, my friends, you know where you are and why you're here. I'm Micah Hanks. This is the Grillion Report. So glad to be here with you as always, keeping you company another Tuesday evening as we transcend physicality and move closer and closer to the darkest corner of the web. We call that Hear the Grillion Report, broadcasting from deep within the hollow earth in the cavernous and sometimes aqueous realm known as the Mohorovic Discontinuity. A lot to talk about tonight, ranging from alleged UFO reports, big game conspiracies, diseases that are going pandemic, and why we might need to be concerned, and a host of other things, including astronomical data. In fact, astronomical feats of every variety. All those kinds of things that you have grown to know and love here on this program that we call the Grillion Report. Good to see everybody out there, and as folks are still filtering into the chat room, a quick hello to Henrik the Odd, JDB, Jimmy and GA, Lindsay, and Wish I Ate the Blue Pill, and all the others who will be here soon, still looking for that enigmatic character we know as the Red Pill Junkie. So how is everyone doing this week? And before you talk out loud as you're driving down the road or you're jogging, for you podcast listeners, I know I can be engaging, but no need for you to respond unless you want to. Of course, I would recommend if you do want to do that, go ahead and just send me an email, info@grillionreport.com. That might be more effective than talking out loud, and the folks around you won't look at you quite so strangely either. But either way, glad to hear from you however you like to reach out. In the news, you know, apparently joggers aren't the only things that are on the move right now. A river of ice in Greenland has become now the fastest flowing glacier currently known in the world, according to one study. Now, back in the summer, the Jakobshav Glacier, widely thought to have spawned the iceberg that sank the famous unsinkable ship known as the Titanic, this glacier is now moving about four times faster than it was back in the 1990s. So what's causing it? Global warming? Who knows? The Greenland ice sheet has seen record melting in recent years and would raise sea levels approximately 6 meters if it were all just to vanish. Now, Ian Yalvin and Ben Smith of the University of Washington's Polar Science Center in Seattle analyzed pictures from a German TerraSAR X satellite to measure the speed of this glacier and how fast it was moving. And this is partially what defines a glacier, as a great big solid sheet of ice that, due to the pressure or the actual immensity of its own weight, is constantly in motion like this. Now, as this glacier moves, according to the researchers involved, they say we can track changes between images to produce maps of the ice flow velocity. How fascinating. In the summer of 2012, the glacier reached a record speed of more than 17 kilometers per year, more than 46 meters per day. That's pretty good. I don't know if they'd outrun a long-distance jogger. Well, who knows? With time. We're now seeing summer speeds more than four times what they were in the 1990s on a glacier, which at that time was believed to be one of the fastest, if not the fastest, glacier in Greenland, according to Ian Jauhin with the team. The researchers noted that the summer speeds are temporary, with the glacier flowing more slowly over the winter months, but that they added that even the annual average speed up over the past couple of years is nearly three times what it was back in the 1990s. Now, again, as we've mentioned, this is believed now to be the fastest flowing feature of its own kind in the world. And according to a professor, Jonathan Bamber, he's a glaciologist. Can you guess what a glaciologist would do? He's with the University of Bristol, and he told BBC News recently it might not be the fastest movement ever observed because some surging glaciers actually can flow extremely quickly for shorter periods, something in the neighborhood of just a few months. Now, the increasing velocity of this particular glacier located in the southwest of Greenland means that it is adding more and more ice to the ocean and contributing to the sea level rise. And as the Arctic region continues to warm, Greenland glaciers have been thinning and calving, or releasing icebergs further and further inland. Now, this, of course, means that even though the glacier is flowing toward the coast and carrying more ice out into the ocean, the calving front is actually retreating. Between 2012 and 2013, the front retreated more than a kilometer further inland than in previous summers, according to scientists in this survey. So the long-reaching effects of what's going on up there in Greenland may be felt both at sea and on land. Either way, it's moving, and it's moving really, really fast. And that apparently, I don't know if it could be necessarily something that we would call concerning. I think it's, well, just a part of nature for the most part, and the kind of thing that we expect to see glaciers doing. But are there elements that are contributing to this more, maybe more so than in the past? Speaking of moving, you may have heard this story about this gentleman who had allegedly been sailing for 13 months. This is his story, at least. He says he's been sailing for 13 months out in the Pacific Ocean, set adrift after he encountered a storm, lost his fuel, and had to survive off of turtles and fish and occasional shorebirds that came out far enough to see that he could kill them and capture them. There are a lot of questions about this story, one of them being, of course, the veracity of whether or not this gentleman had indeed been at sea for 13 months. A lot of people are asking questions about that. It's either way you look at it, a pretty strange story, though. We'll keep you up to date on that one just as well. But for more on that, we discussed it far more in depth on this week's edition of the Middle Theory Podcast, and I recommend that to all the fine folks out there who'd like to get a little more perspective from yours truly and Mr. McNonymous. In the meantime, to West Virginia, or pardon me, West Greenwich, Rhode Island witnesses. That's a little ways from West Virginia, isn't it? They've reported watching and getting photographs, pretty good photographs, too, of what they described as two hovering black disc UFOs at about 5:33 p.m. This took place just a little more, I guess. Well, actually, not even more, just about a week ago. According to a testimony in a case filed with the Mutual UFO Network, the case number being 53853, if you'd like to go look that up. It's now in their witness reporting database. Now, the couple were driving along on a local highway. Well, I don't know if they were a couple, but they were a two. Yes, they were a couple. She refers to him as her boyfriend. They'd seen these objects while looking out the passenger side window. And the woman said, "I told my boyfriend to look, and he grabbed a series of pictures showing the objects standing still in the sky. They appeared to be hovering. They were circular, and they had no lights that we could see." So what were these things that they managed to photograph? We'll have this linked up in the show notes, but the article that was supplied to us was sent from Huffington Post and was written by none other than Roger Marshall. Join us during hour two. He'll be talking about this a little bit. And then, of course, what a lot of folks don't know about Roger is because of the prolific nature of his UFO writing. Roger has had a lifetime of experiences that are also, I guess, what you would call paranormal. I know he calls them that. And he's got a book out called Sacred Dialogue, Tuning into Mother Nature's Universal Broadcast Band. And I can tell you this, Roger Marsh is a lot more than merely what you see at the UFO sites that he writes for. And so I highly recommend that you stick around and hear more about this very compelling UFO case that Roger will be talking about during hour two. The couple, in the meantime, though, we'll talk about this just a moment more. The couple got off at the next exit, drove toward where they saw the objects, and they said, "We lost them in the trees after taking the exit, and by the time we reached the area they were previously above, they were gone. We also saw a helicopter heading in the same direction as we drove closer." I have to say that this one does remind me just a little bit of a case that was reported to me some time back. A young woman had sent along photographs of strange objects moving through the sky. What she had told me, and she hadn't taken the photographs, her friend had, but the friend had supplied the photographs to her and then sent them to me. We featured these on GraylandReport.com, and the images did appear to show some object. I couldn't tell you what this thing was, but some object was traveling through the air and appeared, get this, to be pursued by a couple of helicopters. So here are these two helicopters taking off after this thing. It's just traveling incredibly quickly. And the girl who took the photographs said that the entire story was just, it was just incredible. Having been there, witnessed it, it was just truly a mind-numbing experience for her. And when we posted the photographs there on the website, there was another strange object that appeared. And one of our regular readers had asked, "What is the object there to the right?" And the girl who had supplied the photographs to us told us very casually that, "Oh, those are bird droppings on the windshield." Interesting. But apparently they said that the UFO object had indeed been moving and were not bird dropping so far as they could tell. And whatever the object was, it had been moving fast, maybe almost as fast as some experts are warning that cancer has been spreading. In fact, the word global, paired with another unfriendly word in this context, pandemic, has elicited a bit of alarm. According to the World Cancer Report released by the UN agency, the World Health Organization, the disease, cancer, causes 1 in 8 deaths worldwide. It's estimated 14 million people were diagnosed with cancer in 2012, and 22 million will be diagnosed by 2032. The most commonly diagnosed cancers worldwide are cancers of the lung, breast, and colon. The most common causes of cancer death worldwide are lung, liver, and stomach cancer. In certain areas of Africa and Asia, cervical cancer is the leading cause of death in women. But now the big question that everyone has on their mind is, and this is something that I've wondered too, what is the cause of the increase? Aging and growth of the world population, as well as spread of risk of cancer factors into low and middle income nations, are cited. But does it not seem at times like maybe there is a higher incidence of cancer that we're hearing about more and more? You know, I had a friend over the other night, and we were having dinner, and he mentioned to me, he said, you know, it seems that decades and decades and decades ago, maybe around the turn of not this most recent century, but the last century, that you really didn't hear about cancers quite so often. Now, is it really the fact maybe that certain people are living longer lives? I know my grandfather's lived with prostate cancer, which has been manageable for years. He's 98. And doctors had told my grandfather, you know, you, literally, if you live to be as old as you are, eventually, it's almost inevitable that you're going to contract a version of cancer, some variety or another. But then again, of course, there are also the causes of this unfriendly and disturbing rise, apparent rise, in cancer cases. They include the use of tobacco. Obesity can also lead to cancer. Lack of physical activity and poor diet are also causes. You know, people laugh because I always try to eat extremely healthy. Why do you think? You know, and nowadays, almost anywhere you are, it's not too difficult, usually, to be able to find, if you're willing to pay for it, locally grown, USDA organic vegetables, non-GMO foodstuffs, gluten-free foodstuffs. The report refers to an industrialized lifestyle as being the cause of about half of the cancer deaths, both in the United States and in Western Europe. So I hope all of our British listeners are listening just as well. But at the same time, cancer death rates have declined by about 20% over the past 20 years, too. So there's hope. While there is what has been described as a pandemic rise in cancer rates, and again, I worry a lot about the way that people live their lives. They're not moving enough. They aren't eating the right kind of foods. But cancer death rates have declined because despite the increase, again, what they describe as a global pandemic, apparently, treatments and prevention activities are also helping just as well, including fewer people smoking and doing it less, those who do. Tobacco use in low and middle income countries is causing cancer death rates to increase. Other cancer-causing habits common in the West, such as nutritionally poor or high-calorie diets that promote obesity, are increasing in low and middle income countries as well. But these countries have inadequate medical and public health infrastructures, typically. In economically developing countries, as we alluded already, cancers are often diagnosed at a late stage when eliminating the disease is no longer possible. But people often suffer because palliative care is inadequate. Narcotics are not available for palliative care in more than 24 countries that are difficult to get in many others. So what's the solution here? Is the solution to, well, I mean, in developing countries, obviously, it's going to be more of a hurdle for the time being. But what about in the United States? And what about in countries where we have access to both preventative care, we have also innovative treatment, and we're also absolutely inundated with this quote-unquote industrialized lifestyle that they talk about in this report? You know, it is disconcerting to me that the World Health Organization cites things that very simply could be overcome if people were just aware of it. That's the important thing about being able, and I'm not going to just toot my own horn and say this is the only program that talks about these sorts of things. Frankly, I think a lot of people who are interested in the unexplained would rather not have to hear about potentially deadly diseases. But I'm interested in, and if you want to call it a conspiracy, call it whatever you want to, I'm very interested in why a group like the World Health Organization can put out reports that talk about the fact that, well, industrialized countries, you know, here are the different factors that probably are contributing to cancer. Some of it has to do with poor nutrition. A lot of it has to do with no exercise. And then when we go and we read the reports on foods that are given to us, there's apparently no link between genetically modified foods, you know, processed foods and things like that, and certain varieties of diseases. Although, if you eat too much of certain varieties of foods, especially those aforementioned processed foods, it can be bad for your overall health because you're going to be lacking in a diet that is nutritionally sound. I think about the kinds of foods that I see in school lunchrooms. Back when I was in high school, I think about the kind of junk that was fed to kids. I mean, what they called vegetables looked more like clay. But then again, by the same token also, they have to be able to provide a large amount of food every single day, at least of the work week, to a large number of young people who probably aren't the most conscious about what they're putting into their bodies at that age. Obviously, we face some fairly significant hurdles, and maybe not all the answers are here before us, but I bring it up, I bring it to the table here to discuss because maybe, if we think about it, we can come up with some unique ideas. Another reason I'm glad to be able to be around people like Dr. Robert Schock and his wife, people who are very conscious of what they put into their body and how they live their lives. I hope all of you are too, because I like having you around here every Tuesday night. It is the Graylian Report, and I'm Micah Hanks. When we come back, more weirdness in the news and conspiracies at the big game. High mountains of Appalachia. Welcome back to the program. It is the Graylian Report, and I'm your host, Micah Hanks. So I don't know if you were like me. Some of you probably were watching with bated breath as the Super Bowl was going on. Oh, you know, there's that word you're not supposed to say. I always make fun of that. They tell you to say the big game because apparently NFL is really, really, really protective of their trademarks. But you know, it's a really odd situation there, because there was a story, I don't have all the details, so I don't want to misspeak here, but there was a story online today that had to do with questions over the NFL's nonprofit status. Now, I'm not sure exactly what elements of the NFL are nonprofit, but obviously, I mean, I think that if ever there were a truly, truly beneficial industry for those who are involved in it, I mean, that there's probably few things that you can profit from quite like the NFL when you see something like the hubbub that surrounds that big game that rolls around one Sunday once a year where two games go and duke it out on the, it's not really a battlefield, but a ball field at very least. And yes, this year's big game has been rife with allegations of conspiracy. Now, on the Middle Theory podcast last night, Mr. McNonymous and I, we got into really just kind of talking about the game, although some of you may have seen what I've called, you know, if a person jumps in between you and your pal in the background or in a photograph, you'd call it what? You'd call that a photo bomb, right? Well, this guy, I called him the truth bomb because he ran up on stage and he jumps up on the mic while Malcolm Smith is there talking in the post-game wrap-up. And he jumps up on the microphone and he says that 9/11 should be investigated because it was perpetrated by members of our own government. I'm thinking, very interesting. Huh, okay. We're seeing it even at the big game. It was only after the big game that all the conspiratorial, occult, esoteric aspects started coming out. Now, some of this has to do purely with the idea that the game is rigged. One YouTube, I don't know, what would you call this, not a videographer, but I guess a content provider on YouTube who would manage to garner something in the neighborhood of like 100,000 views within the hours following the big game, had written that the NFL has been fixing games since the early 2000s. Players and coaches are not involved. Only league officials. Public interest in the NFL is at an all-time high, and the past few seasons have been seen record TV ratings in several of the playoff games. The incentive to create the best possible games is too great for the NFL to pass up, and therefore they don't. They rig the games. All the players and the game being played are, of course, real, but the outcomes of certain games are steered in desired directions, often in the biggest games. Sometimes the NFL fails when attempting to fix a game, but when the desired winner loses, even though all the calls go against them, usually they're successful. The NFC Championship was decided on the final play. If a team makes one more play than the other team, usually that team is the winner. In this game, the team that made far more plays was the loser. And so on and so forth. But among the claims of conspiracy that have been involved, some of the most bizarre that I have seen in the last few weeks have been those that were offered by not just the InfoWars crowd, and I know that there have been a number of people in the past who have taken issue with me going after Alex Jones, but I mean, I have to point out, just like during the interview just prior to the game between Bill O'Reilly and Barack Obama, which I have gone on record saying already, I think it was a very interesting interview, maybe the best of his presidency, one of the best interviews I've seen that involves our current standing commander-in-chief. During that interview, Bill O'Reilly said, "I recognize the noble intention behind what you've done, but I don't agree with what you've done." And I think that that's what I would say about, you know, some of the people in the conspiracy zones, so to speak, especially Alex Jones. I recognize Alex Jones as being a person whose intentions are noble, but I also see him as a person who maybe I disagree with him on a lot of things, a lot of his ideas that he puts out there. People in the chat room, that's funny. Jimmy in Georgia just said, it sounds like the WWE. Yeah, yes, exactly. A sport which we know is rigged for entertainment purposes. But so when it comes around to the intention behind people who allege conspiracy theories, I see what they're trying to do and that their intentions are indeed good. But I also question at times their interpretation of what's going on in the world around them, their worldview. You know, this is something I've often said with regard to what we might call the conspiracy mind. I think it's very easy for people to kind of either become indoctrinated into or indoctrinate themselves into a mindset of conspiracy. And we see that, I mean, anyone who would try and say that that's not how things are right now in the United States, the two warring factions between the people who think that every allegation of conspiracy is pure bunk versus the ones that think that everything that happens is a conspiracy, whether it be the big game, the Grammys, and if not a conspiracy, I use that kind of as a catch-all term. I should be careful about that, because a lot of the time what people are alleging more specifically is that there are occult symbols being interwoven into popular media and that are being actually applied directly in performances and things that are televised in prime time, especially those high-yield events where you can expect to have an extremely large audience. There are people who would actually tell you that these are not just probably rigged so as to make these things more beneficial from an economic standpoint, but these things are actually communicating subversive symbology at you that is rooted in ancient occult traditions. Now, one of the most recent allegations of this sort of thing taking place occurred in conjunction with a video that appeared online, and this video had been linked to the InfoWars website, and the gentleman who had been posting the video, his name is Mark Dice. And Mark Dice describes himself as an author and an activist. He authored a book that was called The Illuminati, Facts and Fiction. You can find it on Amazon. It was published in 2010. He's appeared on a lot of different television programs, History Channel programs, things like that. I think he'd been on Conspiracy Theory with Jesse Ventura. He's also been attacked, apparently, by different media outlets, including Rolling Stone magazine, for what they consider to be his conspiracy-driven fear-mongering. Now, I've at least taken a look at what his book has to say. I have not read it. I've looked over the contents, and it does seem to be pretty authoritative in terms of the presentation of the history of organizations, primarily the Illuminati, which in his book he makes the case, he says, that they are still in operation and that they still exist, and that there is still actually an all-powerful ruling elite, and that this Illuminati is actually controlling things like the Super Bowl halftime show. And he includes a video online where he basically equates the entire Super Bowl halftime this year, featuring Bruno Mars and the Chili Peppers. By the way, I thought it was a fabulous halftime show. I thought it was very good. I hope you caught it, and if you didn't, it may be online now. But I mean, it was a very entertaining performance. Bruno really, he kicked it off playing the drums, and he did he just blew everybody's mind with his rhythm skills. He's a really good drummer. Gets up there, sings his butt off. He's dancing. It looks like James Brown come back from the dead, you know, with his dance moves. It was really entertaining. And then the Red Hot Chili Peppers show up, and they do kind of a shortened version of their song, Give It Away. But see, that's where the controversy begins to come in, because the song that Bruno had chosen to sing, I believe the title of the song is Left Out of Heaven, but then again, I've not followed his music that much prior to... Okay, call me a square if you want. I'll say this. I think Bruno Mars gained a lot of fans from the halftime show. You know, and I'll admit completely that prior to the halftime show, I was asking people, who is Bruno Mars and why is he the headliner and not the Chili Peppers? I mean, the Chili Peppers, you know, I kind of assumed were a household name. But you're going to find it very interesting when you hear how Mr. Dice, the aforementioned author we were just discussing, has equated the halftime show and the Chili Peppers and Bruno and the songs that they were singing and the albums that they've produced with being occult sex magic. Here's a short clip of audio where he discusses this.
Well, the 2014 Super Bowl halftime show was just one big sex magic promotion, starring Bruno Mars, who was introduced by a chorus of young children singing with the words prepare flashing behind them, when he then took the stage and just started singing about how sex takes him to paradise with his song Locked Out of Heaven. Very appropriate to have a bunch of children sing along with you about sex taking them to paradise. The song Locked Out of Heaven, many people believe, is a sympathy for the devil song about Satan being locked out of heaven. Of course, he was later joined on stage by the Red Hot Chili Peppers, who are best known for their album Blood Sugar Sex Magic, magic spelled with a K on the end, the same way that sex magic practitioner Aleister Crowley used to spell it, who taught a disgusting, perverted, violent form of occult sex magic where these sickos believe that these sick, perverted practices are used to achieve transcendence and altered states of consciousness.
Now, I will stop there and just say that although he may be an expert, he mispronounced Crowley. He said Crowley. That's a common mispronunciation of the name. I have always been interested in, historically, Aleister Crowley and what he did. And I certainly don't agree with a lot of it. You know, to each his own. I think that the real problem comes into question when I think fundamentally it is a question about how you define sin. And what I mean by that is, is sin a set of standards that are kept in a society? Are they a set of rules that are given to us by a God, a divine being that we are told not to do? For instance, in that archaic interpretation, I think that we could look at a sin as being eating of the fruit of knowledge, as Eve was, of course, led to do by the serpent in the garden. We could look at that mythological interpretation of the first great sin and disobeying God's will. And I think that in strict literalist interpretation, we could say, so I mean, and it never says, apparently. A lot of scholars have pointed out that it's never actually said that the fruit of knowledge was an apple, but especially in a lot of Renaissance art and whatnot, it's been represented as such. But let's just say apple for the ease of argument here. So are we to interpret this as meaning that eating an apple is evil, that it is bad? Now, what does this all have to do with the Super Bowl halftime show and what Mark Dice is saying here? I think the important thing to remember is that he is asserting that this is all sick, wicked, evil sex magic ritual that we're seeing here. And he compares what Crowley did to being that. And then he takes it a step further and he gets into a story that I really don't want to comment on a whole lot on right here. But it has to do with the singer in an English rock band called Lost Prophets. Now, a lot of people who follow the news already know what that had to do with. In very short terms, that man was a pedophile and a very, very, very sick individual. And he's going to be serving, I think, about 35 years in jail. And really, I think should probably be locked up the rest of his life for the kind of stuff that he was into. And Mark Dice makes the connection between the rock music industry, Aleister Crowley, and this whole sex magic thing, and ties it in with that case from last year. I was unaware of this, but it is mentioned in some of the news stories pertaining to that case, which, as I said, I don't want to talk about too much. But the man, the singer of the band, did describe himself as being quote-unquote evil and believed that what he was involved with, which was essentially pedophilia, was both evil but also where he drew his power from, and that he was, quote, cursed, and that he kept getting younger and younger as a result of it. But I don't think that he literally viewed himself as a practitioner of the sort of sex magic, the sort of esoteric tradition that Aleister Crowley had advocated. And whether you agree with or believe any of that, and there are still people who, you know, they adhere to the quote-unquote teachings of Crowley. Again, historically, I find him to be an interesting person. I'm not an adherent to those kind of things, but there are people who are. But I don't think that I don't think that what Crowley was trying to do, per se, was necessarily in keeping with what we saw with the Lost Prophets singer last year. And furthermore, I don't know that we can say that what we see at the Super Bowl is a continuation of an elitist secret society promoting vile sex magic. But that is apparently the insinuation, and one of the reasons he perceives this is because of the fact that as he stated, the Red Hot Chili Peppers had actually called their album, which featured the song that they played, Give It Away. It was a very popular song back in the 90s. The album was actually called Blood Sugar Sex Magic, and they spelled it M-A-G-I-C-K, as Crowley had in reference to the varieties of magic that he practiced. So is there a connection there? I don't know. I don't know, but I know that there have been a lot of people who have been raking Mr. Dice over the coals for inferring all these alleged connections. And some of the other things involved the fact that the lyrics to Bruno's songs were talking about being left out of heaven, all this stuff. There's a big triangle flashing in the background on the stage. Dice had also gone after the fact that the Chili Peppers, he noticed that their instruments were not plugged in. Look, guys, it's pretty common knowledge that at these performances, the music is often, if not entirely, parts of it are canned so that they can rule out the possibility that there are going to be electronic failures and things like that. And anybody who watched the Super Bowl the other night while John Frusciante was taking the guitar solo during the Chili Peppers performance, if anybody thinks that he could gyrate like that, I'm a guitarist, I know this, anyone who could gyrate quite like he did while soloing, you might really be an alien. Yes, but I don't know about an occultist. And I don't know necessarily that it is an obvious intentional, the intent being pure evil, an intentional proliferation of wicked Illuminati practices that we saw there at the Super Bowl. Now, here's a question for you. Surely I think that we can see that in terms of each individual. I'm not trying to attack Mark Dice because, I mean, I think a lot of what he does is funny, and this is something a lot of people don't realize about him. He also is something of a comedian. And a lot of his videos online feature him doing things like going to college campuses, and he'll go and he'll talk to... We talked about this also on last night's Middle Theory. He appears at one college campus, and he's going around gathering petitions from students to have them repeal the Second Amendment, and he is having them sign this, is telling them that we want to get all gun owners off the streets, put them in concentration camps, and execute a few of them. And these students, they're like, yeah, whatever, and they sign the petition. They're not even paying attention. They're willing to sign this petition despite the absurdity that the guy is saying, and he's filmed the entire time, and he's chuckling in between each instance of absurdity. Of course, he doesn't show the people who probably, as he's saying these things, said, what are you talking about, and walked away. I'm sure that the video is edited to make it look a lot more absurd and like there were a lot more sign-ons than the people who said, okay, I opt out. But this guy, again, I think that people don't understand, maybe because they aren't aware really of what he does, that there's a humorous aspect to what he does too, and sometimes in poor taste. In fact, I think just hours after it had been announced that Philip Seymour Hoffman had tragically been found dead in his hotel or in his apartment in New York, Dias had also posted a video online where he was talking in a lispy voice and making fun of the fact that the Illuminati kills actors like this. So he makes a lot of rather odd kind of, again, I think in poor taste, humorous videos, just as well as those which appear to be rather revealing and true as well, or at least truth as he perceives it as being. And this seems to be one of those, this Bruno Mars Illuminati halftime show decoded that InfoWars posted today. But, you know, when you got somebody who is so overtly satirical with what they do, sometimes it can be a little difficult to see exactly what they're trying to say, where they're coming from, and how much of what they're saying is intended to be taken literally. So I'd wondered if this guy was literally trying to just satirize the entire thing. No, I'm not talking about satyrs. I'm talking about satirical, before someone tries to assert that I'm, you know, evoking the Greek god Pan or something like that in an ancient sex magic cult. Although I will say this, though, that, you know, this I think this misinterpretation does lead to a lot of hilarity. There was a link to the Middle Theory site that had been posted on David Icke's forums, and it mentions the fact on a thread about Saturnian death cults, it talks about how, and in the opinion of the person who had posted this, the entire Middle Theory site just looked, there was something off about it. Well, I'll tell you this, because it is satire, in large part. The whole idea of the world's most secret society and all this, I shouldn't really be telling you this, I'm giving away all the secrets here, but in large part, I like to poke fun at this media-driven, and it is largely media-driven, culture of conspiracy in which we live today, where not only are there people who are, because maybe, and this is what I like to posit, maybe they have written books about these subjects and therefore they're going to try and promote ideas that have been represented in their books because they know that that will help sell those books. I think every author to an extent does that, myself included. But being an author, I can recognize that just as well. And I think that sometimes when you hear these kinds of absurd allegations being made about everything, the Grammys, you know, the Academy Awards, the Super Bowl, everything is an occult ritual. There's a great big owl and there's a great big triangle and there's a... Yeah, I think sometimes it can go a little too far, and I wonder sometimes how serious the people who are actually making those claims actually are when they make them. Stirring the pot. Stirring the proverbial pot, I suppose. We'll get back to the news after this, and then stick around during hour two when Roger Marsh joins us to discuss his book, his work, his time writing as a UFO journalist, and of course, all kinds of other things. He's a fascinating individual. I am Micah Hanks. It is the Graylian Report. We'll be back right after this. Darkest corner of the web. It is the Graylian Report, and I'm your host, Micah Hanks. I'm sorry, let me say happy host. Always glad to be here with you every Tuesday night from 8 to 10 p.m. Eastern time. Again, be sure and stick around for Roger Marsh, who may be lingering around there in the chat room. I think I saw him in there during the break. As we're getting back to news, one of the big questions on the minds of researchers, especially out in California, is whether a comet could have caused the extinction of North America's megafauna. Specifically, we're talking about woolly mammoths, giant ground sloths, and saber-toothed tigers. Now, James Kennedy, professor emeritus in the University of California, Santa Barbara, Department of Earth Sciences, posits that such an extraterrestrial event probably did occur around 12,900 years ago. In fact, I think there were a lot of things going on in the world back around that time. That may be an entirely different conversation, though. Now, originally published in 2007, James's controversial Younger Dryas boundary hypothesis suggests that a comet collision precipitated the Younger Dryas period of global cooling, which in turn contributed to the extinction of many animals and altered human adaptations. The nanodiamond is one type of material that could result from an extraterrestrial collision of this sort. And the presence of nanodiamonds along Bull Creek in the Oklahoma Panhandle lends credence to the YDB hypothesis, according to reports. Now, more recently, another group of Earth scientists, including UC Santa Barbara's Alexander Sims and alumna Hannah Alexander, re-examined the distribution of nanodiamonds in Bull Creek's, get this, sedimentological record to see if they could reproduce the original study's evidence supporting the YDB hypothesis, and their findings have appeared recently in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. So in essence, here's what they say. They say that they were able to replicate some of the results, and they did find nanodiamonds right at the Younger Dryas boundary. However, they say they also found a second spike of nanodiamonds more recently in the sedimentary record, sometime within the last 3,000 years. And so the researchers analyzed 49 sediment samples representing different time periods in environmental and climactic settings, and they feel that they identified high levels of nanodiamonds immediately below and just above the YDB deposits and in late Holocene near-surface deposits. This all fascinates me because what it points to is the idea that there indeed were, probably, traumatic Earth changes that occurred, maybe, if this study is correct, within as recently as the last 3,000 years, more likely at least in the last 12 to 13,000 years, something on par with there being a great big, well, a giant comet maybe, striking Earth and causing mass extinction events. And so it's a strange circumstance, but it's nothing particularly new. It's just interesting to be able to see new science being applied to it. Now, a recent meteorite impact did occur near Bull Creek, but scientists don't know exactly when that happened. The fact that the study's second nanodiamond spike occurred sometime during the past 3,000 years suggests that the distribution of the nanodiamonds found at the site is not unique particularly to the Younger Dryas. But interesting nonetheless. And speaking of things that come from space, continually we hear about the possibility that we, you and I, and other life here on planet Earth could actually be the real extraterrestrial life that we so often are seeking. Or at very least, that life as we know it here on Earth could have been fostered, perhaps first by such extraterrestrial interactions in ancient times. Now, I don't know that that's necessarily the kind of extraterrestrial interaction that many with the, for instance, ancient aliens groups would speculate about. But it does seem that the evidence is pointing more and more toward the idea that maybe we come from space, or at very least, that we are made of stardust, or star stuff, as the late Carl Sagan might have said, right? Now, there was a report that appeared in the Science Recorder this week that talked a little about the latest hypotheses in this regard. We don't know for sure the exact origin of life here on planet Earth, but recent developments may be pointing toward a hypothesis for life having some of its beginnings in space, the result of meteor impacts this time rather than comets, that delivered the ingredients necessary to create the first forms of life on planet Earth. Carbonaceous chondrites, or carbon-saturated meteorites, have been found by researchers to contain amino acids, which, as we all know, and we've said it so many times that it's almost blasé to say again, but we will anyway. These are the basic building blocks of proteins, some of which bond to make up DNA, the blueprint for all living things. But scientists have retrieved other biologically important molecules like nitrogen heterocycles, sugar-related organic compounds, compounds found in modern animal metabolisms around the world today. And the problem with applying all this to an extraterrestrial origin of life theory is that out of meteorites recovered after they've hit Earth, less than 5% of them have contained abundant supplies of carbon that would be necessary for the theories being espoused. The molecules of amino acids within these rocks are at extremely low concentrations of parts per million or parts per billion even, and therefore even a large enough meteor may not have been able to provide all of the ingredients for what would eventually become single-celled organisms breeding in the primordial pools upon an ancient, cooling planet Earth. But if you think about it, we think meteorites crashing into Earth are freak occurrences. We think of these things as being something that maybe it could change life as we know it, as it might have done for woolly mammoths and for ground sloths and things like that, some 12,900 years ago or so. But while meteorites are rare events, things coming from outer space and colliding with Earth are hardly rare. In fact, Earth's on a constant collision course with debris that falls from comets, asteroids. This probably happened a lot more in the early days of the planet than it does now. And what this entails, more specifically, is what astronomers and cosmologists call space dust. The literal star stuff, maybe, that Carl Sagan talked about. Or maybe not. But the idea of space dust in ancient times more frequently bombarding the Earth, whether in larger and small quantities, is an interesting idea. In the eons before only single-celled forms of life dominated our planet, the transformation of life may have actually been a pretty gradual process. Now, Michael Callahan of NASA's Goddard Space Flight Center has said that despite their small size, these interplanetary dust particles, this space dust, could have provided higher quantities and a steadier supply of extraterrestrial organic material to early Earth. At Goddard's Astrobiology and Analytical Laboratory, advanced imaging technology may be providing some clues Callahan and his team are right now looking for, which they hope will enable them to be able to inspect really, really small meteorite samples for the first time, where they believe that they have found amino acids. And they say that they have, at least in a few instances. They say that there have in fact been amino acids in a 360 microgram sample taken from what is known as the Murchison meteorite. The sample size, Callahan has said, which is about the weight of several eyebrow hairs, that's pretty small, he says is 1,000 times smaller than the typical sample size used. Now, because of the sensitivity of this technology being employed, researchers are able to collect extremely small samples. I mean, again, really, really small stuff, which they can inspect for organic compounds, thus expanding their search to other planets in the solar system for traces of life. Missions involving the collection of extraterrestrial material for sample return to Earth usually collect only a very small amount, Callahan has said, and the samples themselves can be extremely small as well. But he goes on to say that the traditional techniques used to study these materials usually involve inorganic or elemental composition. Targeting, therefore, biologically relevant molecules in these samples is not routine yet, and we're not there yet, but we are getting there. And once they do, maybe we will have that final conclusive information that we've all looked for, that in our vast search, it hasn't been that vast considering how far we've managed to get from Earth thus far, at least according to conventional accounts, but in our great search, I'll say, for life in the vast expanses of our known universe, maybe we just haven't been employing the right science in its minutia here on planet Earth to ensure that we will find the evidence that, despite our search for aliens, we very well may be the stuff of stars ourselves. Or at very least the byproduct of ancient extraterrestrial interactions with planet Earth. But what about alleged extraterrestrial interactions that may be going on Earth today? We'll be talking with Roger Marsh about this and a variety of other subjects when we come back here on the Grayling Report. So stay with us.
This is the Grillion Report. The unusual, weird news, anomalies, exopolitics. It's beyond the fringe, where conspiracy theory can become conspiracy fact. This is the Grillion Report with your host, Micah Hanks.
Glad to be back with you once again here on the Grillion Report, and here in mere moments, we're going to be going where very few mortals go in their lifetimes with Mr. Roger Marsh. We'll be discussing some of his life, his work with us. I guarantee it'll be a fascinating discussion, but in the meantime, I do want to make a brief announcement, if I may, as I often do. There are ways that you can support the program, and we, of course, always invite you to send along show notes, links to stories you'd like to hear discussed, recommendations for guests. As a matter of fact, we've got a few guests coming up in the next few weeks. I believe we'll have Mac Maloney joining us again here on the Grillion Report, and so I always love to hear from folks out there like you if you've got suggestions you'd like to make about guests you'd like to hear on the program. And the way to do that is to send along an email to me at info@grillionreport.com. Those emails will come directly to me, and we'll see if we can get folks lined up. And, of course, you can also send along stories and things for the daily news. I think that there are going to be some changes coming up with the Grillion Report, but I don't want folks to be bristling when I mention such things as change, because I think a lot of people inevitably will bristle at the mention of such things as change, because change maybe isn't always a good thing. But I can tell you here, it certainly is. I'm of the mind that, well, if things didn't change, there would be no butterflies. We would like butterflies here in the Moho, and therefore, maybe primarily because all we have down here in these dark, cavernous regions of the inner earth are those luminescent cave moths. They're not quite as pretty as butterflies, but I digress yet again. info@grillionreport.com. You're always welcome to reach out to us. We love to hear from you. Now, without further ado, Roger Marsh is a writer with a background in the publishing industry whose recent work documenting UFO reports and case studies has appeared at the UFO Examiner, as well as the Paranormal News Examiner, the UFO Traffic Report, and the Huffington Post. Now, what that essentially means in layman's terms is this guy might be busier than I am. But in addition to his UFO-related work, for which he is best known, Roger has had a lifetime of experiences spanning half a century or more that involve various other varieties of paranormal phenomena. And so tonight he joins us to discuss some of these, as well as his book, Sacred Dialogue, Tuning into Mother Earth's Universal Broadcast Band. Roger Marsh, welcome to the Grillion Report.
Hey, Micah. Thanks. Glad to be here.
Well, I'm glad to have you, my friend. It's always good to hear your voice, and I have to tell people, I hope this isn't cheating, but, you know, Roger and I caught up on the telephone the other day, and we're just going over various things as I was driving to my Brown Mountain Lights meeting, and so it's always good to talk to you. And yet, as life happens, we just don't get to do it often enough, which is one more reason I thought it'd be good to have you on the program. So, again, it's your first time. Welcome to the show. For those out there who aren't familiar with you and what you do, tell us a little bit about your background, because I know you've got a rich background in publishing, and, of course, you're probably one of the more visible UFO writers out there today. So let's hear about how you got into all that.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I spent most of my career in mainstream. I mean, you know, as I was growing up, I don't think I always wanted to work as a writer, but I don't think I ever specifically said, hey, I'm going to be a UFO writer. You just didn't do it, you know, in that time period. So, you know, studied master's degree in journalism and had some pretty mainstream jobs. You know, worked for a decade in book publishing and, you know, had a lot of fun with some pretty major houses, developing books into worldwide markets. But as far as UFOs and what brought me into it, you know, it's the old saying, seeing is believing. As the basis, I mean, I grew up in a great family in southwestern Pennsylvania, you know, stay-at-home mom, dad owned his own business, very successful. But my parents had their own sighting about, I think, 1953, where my mom had gotten up in the middle of the night to use the bathroom, was getting back into bed, and saw this disc-shaped UFO hovering across the building directly across the street. So I was the fourth of eight children, and as I was growing up, you know, very quietly, my dad was buying every book and magazine on the market. You know, it was in the household growing up. But in 1973, at the age of 16, southwestern Pennsylvania in particular was having this huge onslaught of UFOs. I don't even know if I realized it at the time, although my parents were volunteers with Stan Gordon, who's one of the big names in Pennsylvania UFO research. So they would go to the monthly meetings. My father even acted as a professional photographer, you know, when they went out on their Bigfoot hunts, you know, things like that. But in fall of 1973, just after dark on an October night, I'm standing in my neighborhood with about a dozen other people, and all I remember is somebody pointing down the street and said, "What is that?" And we all looked that direction, and it was this disc-shaped UFO just right above the telephone pole. So the telephone pole is about 40 feet, so 41, 42 feet. It's the width of the two-lane road, completely silent, just came at us at about, a leisurely maybe 10 miles per hour. Like, you don't know what's holding the thing up, you know, for the size of it. And it just went right over the top of us. And then in Pennsylvania, you know, following the lay of the land, it just sort of went down over the hill and over what is now Route 30. So it was just an incredible introduction to ufology. And I've been a fan ever since. And then later in my life, when I was kind of stepping away from the corporations and looking for my own personal projects, I did approach the Mutual UFO Network, also known as MUFON, with a writing experiment. As a professional journalist, I wanted to cover UFOs on a daily basis. And I started doing that in January of 2009 and haven't looked back.
Yeah, and I have read probably more of your different reports and blogs and articles than I could probably count over the years. And so you're really prolific with it, and you're still doing it. In fact, earlier in this program, and you may have heard this, because I saw you lurking in the chat room there earlier.
Sure.
We discussed this thing that's going on in Rhode Island, where a couple of photographs of black discs were taken. Now, I have to ask a question, and I hope this isn't too silly, but in the photograph, since we actually have a photograph, we don't see a whole lot of photos that are good quality. This one's fairly good, all things considered.
Great, yeah.
For UFO photo, it's really good. Is that anything like the initial encounter that you had? I mean, do those objects, or can you tell, are they too far out? Can we tell anything from this photo?
You know, I'll have to wait until the photo analysis comes back. We'll have to see what Rhode Island MUFON does with it. It's pretty early. The report, I think that just happened on Friday, so they're probably, I'm sure it's been assigned by now, but it will be interesting. But if you compare that photograph, and I know we're on radio, so people can't see it, but, you know, I'm looking at I'm a blogger for the Huffington Post, so I posted the photo, and that's actually an enlargement. So the photo, I mean, the object's got to be, I'm not that great at guessing distances, but, you know, it's got to be a few thousand feet from them, you know, mm-hmm. where my own personal report, I mean, this dang thing was 41, 42 feet from me. I mean, you're looking right up at the bottom of the craft, you know, as it goes over. And you may have noticed in my writing over the years, I do tend to focus on the closer, you know, to land reports. Anything under 500 feet, I'm on the edge of my seat, you know, reading every word.
Yeah.
And actually, this report, it's funny you brought this one up, because I was just talking with some other members of MUFON that just since last Thursday, I've actually covered 7 pretty similar reports. This was one of 7, and from 7 different states. I mean, I covered, that's a Rhode Island case. I covered a case out of North Carolina where it was a cylinder. Ohio, it came down and hovered over a field. It was a triangle. There was a sphere in Georgia. There was this fireball-looking thing out in Oklahoma. I mean, the size of a van, I think the woman said. A round-looking object, you know, over Oregon, and a triangle right over Kalamazoo, Michigan. And if you read the reports, it's either one or two people. I think this was the only person of the 7 reports that actually snapped a photo. I'm pretty sure. Everybody else, we're just, you know, again, on the edge of our seats, listening or reading, you know, every word of their descriptions of what they were seeing.
Mm-hmm.
And again, like mine, if you clocked my sighting, I don't think I saw it 30 seconds. I think it was maybe more like 20 seconds. By the time I saw it, it moved toward me, moved overhead. And then again, with the rolling hills in Pennsylvania, you know, it doesn't take that long for it to, like, disappear if it's staying right at the treetop level. And all of these people, all of these seven reports are saying pretty much the same thing. Hey, I saw this thing at, like, the treetop level, you know. In fact, the Rhode Island one, that's probably a bit further higher in the sky, the other six reports, you know, hovering over a field right over the one woman from Oklahoma, 100 feet over the roof of her home. So you kind of see it, and it's there in your airspace. It's either hovering briefly, and then they don't move away fast. They just sort of meander away. We do, of course, have many cases where they come into your airspace like they're kind of checking you out.
Yeah.
Then they kind of turn, you know, maybe arc up a little bit, and then boom, it's like a bat out of hell. But just lately, it's sort of the, hey, we're here, okay, we see you, we're just meandering away.
That's interesting too, isn't it, Roger? I mean, that so many of these reports do entail these meandering aircraft, whereas, I mean, one of the most revelatory stories I remember reading about, it had a lot to do with who actually saw it, from his Cessna prior to his presidency, Ronald Reagan had described seeing one of these objects that had been, it looked like the headlight maybe of a plane behind them that was pacing them. And then that thing, they said, elongated and then took off like a hot rod at such an incredible speed that they couldn't account for that being any known aircraft. And I'm hearing this thinking, my God, you know, this is a man who went on to be president of the United States who talked about seeing this. You know, his guards saw it. The pilot had described this thing. They all saw this. What could do that? But the other question, too, you know, why do we not hear more reports like that today where these things just take off at tremendous speed? They do seem to be almost more casually observing whatever these craft are.
Yeah, I mean, they're out there, but it's the same weirdness. If you went through just these seven reports, it's almost like there's seven different shapes. Even if you say, hey, look, Rog, you covered a triangle in Ohio, and that was, that actually occurred February the 3rd. That occurred yesterday. And then there was a triangle, Kalamazoo, Michigan. That was Friday. No, I'm sorry, last Thursday, the 30th. I'll bet if you read into those reports, I don't have the full report in front of me, but I'm sure there's a difference in size on them. So it's like I usually tell people, it's like, you know, the old theory of UFOs, we wanted to think of it like, you know, Henry Ford's Model T factory. Oh, this year, you know, the new models are getting fins this year. You know, ooh. But it almost seems like they are manufactured objects. They look to be manufactured, but it's almost like every customer gets a custom model.
Isn't it? Yeah.
It's just not exactly the same. And that kind of, you know, it's just another in that long list of stuff like, crap, we don't know. there's so much more that we don't know than we know.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, Roger, you and I have corresponded a lot over the years, but I know what got you and I recently in touch with one another again was that you had contacted me with regard to musings about the apparent relationship between other kinds of paranormal phenomena, ghosts, for instance, in relation to UFOs. And what you're describing right now is precisely what we're talking about, and it's a great segue into the realm of the other. Because so often there is, and I don't mean this in the way that it's an imagined experience, but there is a subjectivity where each person seems to, what they see, and from case to case, report to report, object to object, they do seem to be different, as though they are customized, like you've said. It is odd, isn't it? But you see that in other areas of the unexplained just as well, do you not?
Definitely, because I think we're, at my age, I just turned 57 this past Friday, and at my age, I think just, you know, 10, 20 years ago, everybody wanted to chop it up, okay? Mm-hmm. One group was studying, you know, ghosts and hauntings. Another group is studying crop circles. Another group studies Bigfoot. And suddenly we're all in the field. We're all looking at each other going, wait a minute. Maybe this is all somehow connected.
Yeah.
And I mean, even MUFON, I mean, I'm director of public relations, and I can tell you that 5-10 years ago, you know, within MUFON, you really stuck to UFOs. I mean, you acknowledged that we had ghost hunters out there and crop circles, you know, but you didn't intermingle the two topics. And I know now, you know, MUFON, for example, has a division that just studies alien abduction, another group that's studying crop circles. And I think we're all looking at each other saying, the Bigfoot creature, you know, how is that, you know, how is that also connected?
Well, you know, Stan Gordon would have something to say about that, wouldn't he?
Right. I was the editor on his book, Silent Invasion, which came out fall of 2010. If your listeners have never read that book, it's incredible because it's designed and written as a case book where literally he starts with the first case over a period of a year. And he was just, southwestern Pennsylvania in particular, was just inundated with these UFO reports. And then all of a sudden, the Bigfoot reports started coming in. And the best story I could tell is, again, think of the rolling hills in Pennsylvania. You could have two neighbors, one each living on a side of a hill opposite each other. They don't know each other because they use different access roads. One of the neighbors calls Stan and reports, you know, a disc UFO hovering 50 feet over their backyard last night at 9 o'clock. He hangs up, the phone rings, it's the family on the other side of the hill saying, hey, at 9 o'clock last night there were three Bigfoot creatures, you know, 7 feet tall, completely covered with hair, standing on 2 feet, standing in my backyard. I mean, you almost have to connect the dots that we had this surge in Pennsylvania, you know, from 73 to 74, and even though both phenomena still exist to this day, probably a much higher percentage of UFOs, but the Bigfoot phenomena continues. I mean, every year there are dozens of reports, dozens of sightings, not the hundreds of sightings, you know, from 73, 74, but then you get into other areas of the paranormal, like telepathy. Okay.
Oh, you know, well, that's a good one right there. I tell you what, Roger, hold on to that thought, because when we come back, I want to really dig into that with you.
Okay.
There's so much we could discuss here. And by the way, that was very generous of you to mention Stan's book in depth there. I also want to get into yours, though. I want to be generous next, because what you get into in your book is so fascinating. And whether it has to do with telepathy, whether it has to do with cryptozoology, UFOs, you've got a lot to lend to this. We're talking with Roger Marsh. The book I'm discussing here is Sacred Dialogue, Tuning into Mother Nature's Universal Broadcast Band. Roger is a UFO journalist. He's an all-around journalist, all-around good guy with a great background in editing, publishing, you know, and he's also, I think, someone who provides maybe an almost singular perspective to this phenomenon. That's why it's so important to talk to him tonight, and I'm glad to be the host who's conducting this interview. I'm Micah Hanks. It is the Grayling Report. Stay with us. We'll be back right after this.
Imagine no longer being tied down to your computer, but having the freedom to take live talk radio with you anywhere you go. TalkStream Live introduces our first ever iPhone application. The talk shows you follow now follow you, and your iPhone is now the fastest and easiest way to stay connected to the best talk radio on the internet. Let TalkStream Live transform the way you listen to radio. Listen to live talk shows 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Mobile talk radio from TalkStream Live. Now available in the iTunes App Store.
Imagine a place, beautiful, green, sloping mountains, and a rich, mysterious window into our ancient past. It's a culture the likes of which you won't find anyplace else. And while the place I'm describing is in Vermont, it's also the home of Inner Traditions, publishers of fine books on mind, body, and spirit for more than three decades. Inner Traditions are internationally recognized publishers of everything from occult to esoteric and spiritual books, as well as the leading authorities on alternative health, holistic healing, sacred sexuality, altered states of consciousness, and so much more. And frankly, it's not the kind of information you'll find just anywhere. Exploring the inner secrets of humanity requires thinking outside the box. And when it comes to Inner Traditions, the name says it all. All you have to do to learn more is visit innertraditions.com and you can receive a free catalog that will tell you all about their latest books and newest authors. That's Inner Traditions and Bear & Company, publishers of fine esoteric books for more than three decades. Find them online at innertraditions.com.
Monsters could be living under your child's bed or in the bathtub. For a child with asthma, it can seem like monsters are everywhere because something as innocent as a teddy bear could trigger their next asthma attack. But there are simple ways you can help, like putting stuffed animals in the freezer to kill dust mites and drying bath toys to prevent mold. Learn more at noattacks.org or call 1-866-NO-ATTACKS. That's 1-866-NO-ATTACKS because their next breath is in your hands. Brought to you by the EPA and the Ad Council.
From the heart of the Mohorovic discontinuity, where things are not always cute and cuddly, I'm glad nonetheless to be your host each week on this program we know as the Graylian Report. I'm Micah Hanks. Now, we're picking up where we left off in the last segment. Our guest tonight, Mr. Roger Marsh, he's a fascinating individual, and he's a man who has had a lot of experiences of his own over the years. Best known as a UFO writer and researcher, but there's a lot more meat on the bone, as they say, when it comes to this discussion. Now, Roger, where we left off, I had to interrupt you as you were getting to the fascinating discussion of that subject we call telepathy. I want to talk about that a little, and I'll let you pick up right there.
Well, I mentioned telepathy because there again, that's like another piece of the paranormal that we all either grew up with, read about it, and then suddenly we find that it could be related to ufology.
Mm-hmm.
In my own, if you read the book Sacred Dialogue, in my first chapter, I talk about the alien abduction experience, that I went through a series of experiences between the ages of 5 and 16. In that period, I had no idea what all this was. It wasn't until, like, after I had gotten married and all these TV shows were coming out of the 90s, I went, hey, who stole my story? Who took all those details, you know, and lined them up, you know, so exact? But the abduction process, and this is what I'm finding out as I talk to abduction experts around the country, Harvard professor John Mack and I had spent some time together. He, of course, is deceased now, but he was one of the leaders in the field. Kathleen Martin, you know, currently, you know, one of the leaders in the field. She also leads that division with MUFON in our studies. But Kathleen, for example, last weekend, she and I were on the telephone, and she was talking about a study that she had done of people who claim to have been abducted, and they matched that against another group that had not claimed abduction. And she found that if you had claimed the abduction experience, you had an 88% chance of also claiming to have a lot of paranormal activity in your life, including telepathy. And again, if you read my book, that, you know, telepathy is kind of one of the main ingredients, you know, for me. that it's a day-to-day thing. It just, it happens 3, 4, 5, 6 times a day. You know, information, coming and going. And again, you kind of have to read the book. I kind of covered the whole gamut of paranormal activity with me. I've really experienced, quite a bit in my life, all kinds of things. I even have a chapter just to satisfy the mainstream reader. I have a chapter on ghosts and hauntings in there and a chapter on cemeteries. But, I have my own theories on that stuff. I'm kind of jumping around here, but I kind of feel that the paranormal, I think where we're going to end up someday is an understanding that what we currently call the paranormal is actually Mother Nature. It's just an extension of our own brains, things that we can do. It seems kind of odd right now. We don't know how to control it. The media, of course, wants to constantly harp on haunted houses and these ghost hunting TV shows and, ooh, isn't it spooky? Let's go into a cemetery. And I put chapters in my book because, I mean, my best friends will say to me, I'll never walk through a cemetery with you.
Oh, yeah?
If you walk through a cemetery with me, something's going to happen, trust me, okay? And it's usually something kind of unique and odd or, out of the ordinary. So I've actually done 3 documentaries. I've, written and directed, produced 3 documentaries where I've gone to haunted places that call themselves haunted. And I go in as a paranormal journalist, not as an investigator. I go in to capture the story, but something always happens to me. But I really, truly believe the paranormal can happen anywhere. Yeah. Your living room.
Oh, yeah. And I know people. I mean, I'll just very briefly tell you, I had to go visit my mother a couple of summers ago because she called me. She didn't even call me. It was my father that called, and he was concerned. He says, listen, would you come over for dinner tonight? And I said, yeah, I guess. What's going on? He says, your mom would kind of like to talk to you about something. And I thought, oh, God. We've got a family issue going on. No, it's nothing like that, no. And my dad explains to me that my mother had seen what she perceived as being a ball of light in the living room. She's sitting there watching television, and a bluish ball of light appears, and she didn't know what it was, and I didn't know what to make of it. But, I mean, all sometimes you can do is to go and sit and talk to somebody who has had that experience. But now, Roger, you being someone who has had that experience, you mentioned that your friends, of course, they say they won't walk through a graveyard with you. I know you to be a person who has had these experiences, and yet you also do have a very different perspective of these kinds of things. And while we're on the subject of ghosts and hauntings, give me some idea of, how you perceive that phenomenon. What is going on in your mind when a person perceives something that we would call ghostly?
It's kind of summed up in my title, Sacred Dialogue.
Mm-hmm.
The conclusion that I came to by the time I hit the 90s, okay, at first, it's like when you're young, okay, when you're asleep, your body's very relaxed. So the paranormal can kind of sneak in through dreams, and you can have prophetic dreams of the future, which I began having as a kid. And I just think as you get older, I call it noise starts creeping into your life. You get behind the wheel of a car, what's the first thing you do? You pick up the phone, you make a phone call, you turn the radio on. Okay, we don't do enough kind of relaxing and kind of sitting back. And I have to kind of laugh, and just low-key, the people that think I have to have all this electronic equipment, and you look at these ghost investigators and they're going into a site and, they've got all these electronic things and wires going everywhere. And if I lecture on the subject and people say, what can I buy? I'll spend my life savings. I want to experience what you're experiencing. And I'll usually say, it's simplicity. You don't need anything.
Right.
My best experiences were with nothing. I could just walk into a cemetery or a place that's known, okay? But at the same time, I mean, I do own a high-definition video camera. I have a very nice Canon digital still camera. I have a digital, tape recorder. So I do have a few things where I could set up, and show things. that are going on, but I really believe that the paranormal is a subtle thing. But then I got to a point where so many things were happening to me, and in so many different directions. Like, it wasn't just the dream state. It would be like these screens popping up and giving me information, all of this information just pouring into my head, you know. And again, 99% of it's all very simplistic, okay?
Mm-hmm.
I only had a couple of moments in my life where I actually got a national news story, you know, the night before it happened. But it's all, again, it's just very natural. But by the 90s, I really started, like, I had kept notes since I was, like, 12 years old. I had this, you know, folder where every time I would have one of these experiences, I would write it down, then I started typing them and sticking them in here. And finally, I got them all out and started assembling them. And if you look at them as a whole, it almost appeared as though there was this series. You could look at them and call them a series of interactions with an intelligence. It's almost like there's this other intelligence that's kind of monitoring me and going, hey, you know, cross the street, do this, you're going to meet so-and-so, or, you know, they're feeding me information. And I decided to write the book to, like, explain all of this. And I knew that if I gathered, you know, 100 people into a room and said, well, what is the intelligence? What do you think it is? You know, one person's going to say God. One's going to say, oh, it's your guardian angel. Somebody else, no, it's your spirit guide. And the list just keeps going on and on and on. And I didn't want to get trapped in that sort of label area, so I just decided to call it sacred dialogue. That you could just truthfully, I guess I would sum the book up by saying that I believe that all information, past, present, and future, is available at any single point. And you don't need all the electronics. People get very frustrated with me. No, tell me something to buy.
Yeah, exactly.
No. But I'll buy the best one. I'll buy the German one. You know, no, don't do it.
Well, you know, in a way, Roger, it's like love. You know, remember what the Beatles said, money can't buy me love. And I don't think that money can buy you into an experience. But I think that what we see in our culture today, and it's not just it's not just with those things we would call paranormal. People want so badly to have any kind of experience along these lines that they'll do anything that they perceive that they could to buy their way into it or to otherwise attain whatever that is that they're trying to find. You know, I see the same thing in the cryptozoological circles just as well. When you think about people going out into the woods, and you may laugh, but the way I perceive this is, if you watch Finding Bigfoot, people are going out in the forest, they're yodeling, they're banging rocks and sticks together. It is the modern equivalent of what in the South here we have called for years the snipe hunt.
Yeah.
It is people going out in the woods. They're engaging in a snipe hunt. And, you know, I don't mean that to take away from...
No. And I don't. I've been out in groups like that, and I think people are having fun. I mean, I just think they enjoy going out, you know, and gathering. But I know that when I have a paranormal experience, it's usually very low-key, very light. It's often even funny. It's almost like the paranormal... I often say there's a sense of humor going on there.
There really is.
I don't understand it, you know. And it just, you know, I don't mean to say that you can't go out and buy the equipment, buy the best camera, you know. But I just think I would have a hard time selling a paranormal reality TV show to Hollywood. I just think they'd look at me. I'd be like the Seinfeld guy. Like, it's a show about nothing. Like, and they'd look at me, and hopefully there's a George sitting next to me. You know?
Yes, exactly. Well, you know, every Johnny Carson's got to have his sidekick. You know, his Ed McMahon, I guess, in this case. You know, Roger, in your book, and this is something I noticed throughout the book, you meticulously note your own personal experiences. You note dates and whatnot. Is that something that you always did? I mean, or do you have an absolute ability to just instantly recall those dates?
Oh, No. I've always kept like a journal of this stuff. I did stop that after I wrote that book.
Really? Why?
Yeah, and my wife is constantly saying to me, you know, you ought to write that down. It looks better if you have the date and time. And it's also great for research when you look back, you know, at events to see, well, oh, I had more of that kind of an event. Because I go through it in waves. Sometimes I think I fight it off because I'm just busy, you know. I mean, I said to my wife at dinner today, I don't know where the hours went. You know, I covered 3 stories today, you know, handled a situation with CNN, and then I had to, you know, run over and make these 3 phone calls. And, like, all of a sudden the day went by. So I probably had a paranormal experience at some point, and I just don't remember it, you know.
Well, as busy as you are, I tell you, I'm very blessed to be able to have you here on the program tonight. We're talking with Roger Marsh, and his book is Sacred Dialogue, Tuning Into Mother Earth's Universal Broadcast Band. There are a lot of stories in this book, and really good ones, personal experiences. I mean, is there a good one that you would be willing to share with the listeners right now?
Oh, boy. Because I love to tell some of the more simpler stories, mm-hmm. where it's almost like a funny ending to it. But actually, let me tell you about 2 experiments that I did. I think that the audience, when they walk away from this broadcast, some people are going to be saying, "Now, how can I do that? How can I get involved?" Okay, and I got to a point in the 90s. I lived in Chicago for 20 years. And my wife at that time lived in Forest Park, which is a Chicago suburb, directly west of the heart of the city. And we lived in a 2 flat. And we had just only been married, I think, just a couple of years. We had a baby still in the crib. And it was a, you know, real nice, very clean, you know, nice hardwood floors, you know, 2-bedroom apartment. And we had we were on the 2nd floor, but the 1st and 2nd floor had a very large, like, balcony, you know, off the back of it. And then there was a yard that went back to a parking area. And then there was a garage. Now, the people on the 1st floor, they had rented the garage. We got the 2 parking spaces. And I had this little Mazda pickup truck that was parked out there. So, and our apartment from the back to the front, the back was a very large kitchen, and there were 2 doors off that room, my daughter's bedroom and a bathroom. Then you went to the center of the apartment was a dining room with a door to the master bedroom, and the front of the apartment was just, you know, a large living room. So this was after dinner, and I had been thinking about the paranormal and, you know, probably looking over my notes. And I did an experiment, and I probably did this a few nights earlier, where I said, okay, I really believe it's possible to interact with whatever you want to call this intelligence. And I said, if anything bad is going to happen to me or my family, okay, I want an advance warning. Now, in this particular case, I'm watching television. Now, that had been put in place, and I just fake it. Maybe I told my wife about it. So I'm watching television, and my wife was, I think, with the baby, with Lainey, in her room, and something sort of caught my attention in my peripheral vision, and I looked to my left, and I saw my back door opening, coming into the kitchen, and this sort of short, pudgy, older guy with a long, dark overcoat stepped into my kitchen holding a handgun. And I immediately, wow. I became alarmed. I mean, I stood right up, and I looked at him, and I mean, I would have been ready to have taken him on. I mean, the wife and baby are just one room over. Mm-hmm. So I probably would have charged the guy at some point, you know, taken the first bullet, as they say.
Yeah.
But I stood up, and I looked at him, and he made eye contact with me, and then all of a sudden, he dissolved.
Oh, wow.
And I'm standing there going, oh my God. And so I ran, you know, into the kitchen. I looked around to make sure that, you know, he was definitely not there. I looked, I could see wife and baby, and I stepped out onto the porch, looked around, didn't see anybody, so I went and I told my wife about it, and I said, you know, when I have these visions like that, it's usually going to happen within the hour, okay? I have a lot, at that time I was having a lot of visions of, hey, this is going to happen within the hour, or this is happening ahead of you in traffic, okay? So my wife said, okay, we're going to my mother's house for the night. So we very quickly, in a matter of minutes, packed up, went out, got into my wife's car, and we drive, okay, down to my mother-in-law's. We get there, and I said to my wife, you know what? I have the feeling it's passed. I'm going back to the house. I go back to the house, have to go get her the next day and the baby. Okay, so at that point, okay, we think we've had a paranormal experience, but we really don't know the end of the story until a week later. And I talked to the neighbor who lives directly behind me. And he has a part-time job with the local Forest Park Police Department.
Mm-hmm.
And he says, have you heard what's been happening in our neighborhood?
Mm-hmm.
And I said, no. And he said, well, this guy has been walking up and down the alley, and he's been, and it's all two flats in that neighborhood, and he'll look for lights on in somebody's apartment, and he just turns your handle and walks in. And I said, could you describe this guy? And he goes, yeah, it's an older guy, like, you know, 50s, early 60s, short, you know, always has that long, dark overcoat on, and he uses a handgun. Mm-hmm. And my friend had been at a neighbor's home a couple of doors up that same night and was up on the second floor talking with the neighbors when the man with the gun walked in the door and robbed them. He never hurt anybody. So, like, that was sort of the end of the story. I went home and said, wow, I did dodge a bullet. Now about these two stories were about a week apart from each other. Again, I'm in the living room watching television, looking at notes, and all of a sudden, I lose my vision in the room. I'm no longer looking at the TV. I'm outside in our parking area, kind of squatted down next to my pickup truck, and the door of my pickup truck is hanging open. It's like I'm inside the body of a guy about to rob me. And he's looking at my dashboard at the aftermarket radio I've got in there. And he keeps looking at that, and then his eyes go up, and he's looking at the back porches on the first and second floor. And he's extremely nervous, okay? He's sweating it. So all of a sudden, I, like, snapped out of it, and my vision came back to the living room. I stood up, and I'm yelling to my wife, there's somebody on the driveway about to break into my car. And I go heading to the door. My wife, who was born and raised in Chicago, says, don't you dare. They all have guns. Do you want to lose your life over a, you know, a $200 radio?
Right, yeah.
And so I stopped in my tracks, and I'm like, oh, man, he's out there. I know he's out there. So I went over to the door, and I just jiggled it real hard to make noise of metal. And I stood there for about a minute, and then I finally stepped out on the porch, looked down over the lawn, looked at my car, my pickup truck door, the driver's door is hanging open. Nobody's around. So I walk down casually, look around the alley. Nobody's around. There's my door. It was locked, and he had popped it somehow. And I, you know, I relocked it. You know, the radio was not disturbed. Closed the door.
Wow.
But you see where you're getting something after the story. It's not just that I had this vision that could have been creative thought in my living room. When these things happen to me, they're real.
Yeah, oh, it sounds like it. Absolutely, especially when there's a guy who comes in brandishing a gun and you're sitting there looking at the man when he disappears. That's just incredible, Roger.
Right, but let me take it a step further for your listeners.
Okay.
And there's two very quick stories.
Sure.
I'm telling this to a colleague of mine in Chicago. I work for a pretty high-end publishing house. We're having coffee. She was really into the paranormal, and we're telling stories. And I told some of these stories about setting these things up. And she was asking me about the range of different things that I had experienced. And she said, well, can you do remote viewing? Can you just, you know, I call it lying down Edgar Casey style. and I can go into like a trance and look at different things, okay? Or, you know, even call up crimes. You know, I've experimented in many different ways. So she said, can you do that in real time? And I gave her a couple of examples. And she said, well, I'm going out tonight, and I'm not going to tell you where I'm going, who I'm with, but at 9 o'clock tonight, okay, I want you to do your thing, as my wife calls it, do your thing, and tomorrow at coffee in the morning at work, you tell me what I was doing. So at the appointed hour, you know, lay down, meditate, and I'm very, you know, I believe you could set this up. You could actually say to yourself, I'm going to relax my body in 1 minute. Okay, I have no patience for the paranormal.
Yeah.
none of this, the first name begins with the letter F. Either give me the full name or get out, you know. So I'm going to be relaxed in 1 minute. A screen is going to pop up, and I'm going to see this woman, okay, exactly where she's at in real time, in full color. None of this black and white stuff, okay? So I actually think like that, you know, kind of kidding a little bit. So I do it, okay? And I see this woman with like five other women seated around a round table. They're definitely in some kind of a restaurant situation. But I notice that the room in the background has these beautiful wood panels on the wall. And I notice that they're in the center of the room with all these other round tables and that there's five other women, you know, with her. And I look down at the table, and I notice that they're drinking tea, but specifically out of black teacups, which I thought was kind of out of the ordinary. So I typed this all out, printed it, and I showed up with this meeting the next morning with the woman, had it in my pocket, and I said, okay, where were you last night? Well, I was out with my, you know, we had a dress fitting, you know, I'm getting married, these are the, you know, maids of honor, and, you know, five people in the wedding party, the women, you know, and I took them out to tea at such and such tea room in Chicago. And I said, were the tables round? Yes. Were you in the middle of the table? Yes. Was there dark paneling around the edge of the room? Yes. And specifically, were you drinking out of black teacups? She just about fell over. Well, I pulled it out. It was all pre-printed.
Yeah.
I couldn't have just said, oh, yeah, that's what you were doing. So she looks at me and says, well, can you now look into the future and do this? Okay, so we did the same arrangement 1 week into the future. I came in the next morning with a typed sheet. I said, I see a boulevard in Chicago. I see your fiancé's Lexus parked along, you know, one side of the street. I see a U-Haul coming down the street with two Mexican men in plaid shirts, okay? And they sideswipe the whole side of the Lexus, and it's a hit and run. So this is all written down. I give her the copy. She kind of smiles, kind of laughed, and said, okay, okay. So a week went by. One day she comes racing into my office and she slams the door. And she says, you're not going to believe it. But we were having another dress fitting, and my fiancé decided to surprise us. And he just showed up, parked his Lexus across the street. But when we went out, it had been sideswiped. But we know nothing about a U-Haul, nothing about Mexican gentlemen, nothing. It was a hit and run. Wow. Next morning, she comes in and says, you're not going to believe this one. There was a witness who called the police and said it was a U-Haul and that there were two Mexican men driving it. The police tracked the damage done to the, you know, probably front side of the U-Haul truck. And indeed, they were discovered.
So
everything was accurate except the plaid shirts.
Unbelievable. That's so incredible. So the question is, are you psychic? What is it? How are you able to do that? Or how would anyone be able to do that? What's going on there? And I know that's a really tough question. But
No, it is, because other things happen. Again, I can't in this short space go into it. You have to read the book to see the range of things. It's like the cemetery stuff, okay? I had a date one time before I was married, and I'm in grad school, and I lived in an apartment complex right next to a cemetery. So I'm telling this girl about, you know, how I can't walk through cemeteries because things always happen. And, of course, What does she want to do? We're walking through a cemetery. Let's go.
Oh, let's go. So, come on.
Let's go. Come on. I want to do it.
Right.
So we walked into the cemetery, and, of course, there's hundreds of graves everywhere. And she says, well, what's the experiment? I said, all right, you go out. Go away from me. Go out far so I can't see. Pick a grave at random. Just pick one. Any grave, pick a grave. And sit on it so that I can't see the, you know, anything. And I got to a certain point where definitely I could not see anything. And I'm standing there and I said, okay, it's a woman. She died at the age of 87. She's local. She's, you know, right here in Olean. She's from. And I started spitting out all these other details. I'm just talking very fast. And finally I just stopped and the young lady stood up. I walked up. My God, it was a female. Well, I had a 50-50 chance of that. She did die at that age, okay? All the other information, I would have no way of knowing, you know? So the young lady became a little upset over this. And she said, no, this is kind of upsetting to me. Let's go back to your apartment. You know, I don't feel right. So we go back, we're sitting in my living room, and she says, I have to know if you actually were in touch with this deceased woman, okay? And she said, could you try to connect with her? Well, now, sometimes I just get funny. I have, you know, I get a little theatrical, you know.
Sure.
look at the Austrian incident in the book. Okay, so I stood up in the living room, and I was a little theatrical, and I said, look, and I'm referring to the name on the gravestone, I said, if you really were interacting with me, if you're real and I'm really dealing with somebody on the spiritual side, I said, could you give us a sign? And the timing was absolutely perfect. Right as I said the word sign, around the corner, if you went from my living room to my dining room into the hallway that went back to the bedroom and bathroom, in that hallway on the ceiling was a smoke detector. Now, there was no smoke in the apartment. Nothing was going on. The smoke detector goes off. So we ran over, and I look up at it, and, of course, there's no smoke. There's nothing going on, and we couldn't get it to shut off. I mean, I think instinctively I ran into the kitchen, and I got a towel, and I started brushing the air around it. Well, that's what you would do if, you know, you burnt something on the stove and something went off. So I got a little step stool out of my kitchen, and I climbed up, and this was a battery-operated, you know, the apartment complex just stuck a couple of these in every apartment, and I reached up, pulled the cover off, and I pulled the battery out. And, of course, the thing automatically went off. So we go back in the living room. Now she's very upset. I'm thinking, uh-oh, we better stop talking about the paranormal. But she says, no, that could be a coincidence. Do it again. I'm standing there holding the battery in my hand, and I said, okay, and I refer to the grave again. I said, you know, that was a pretty neat trick that you just did, but we're not totally buying it. If we are communicating with you, give us another sign. And all of a sudden, the smoke alarm goes off.
Oh, really?
And the young lady looks at the battery I'm holding in my hand, and she starts, at that point, screaming bloody murder, and she kind of ran from the apartment complex at that point. Now, it took me a year or two, but I remember the name of the manufacturer on the smoke alarm, and I wrote them a very nice letter. And I said, is there any way that your smoke alarms retain, you know, juice in there if I would pull the battery out? And I explained the story, what went on, the grave, you know, and everything we had done. Well, I get a telephone call at my office from the company. They said that they were so taken by my letter that they copied it so that everybody in the entire company could read it. And they were calling me to tell me, no, when you pull the battery out, you got no juice. And there's no way that that thing could have gone off.
And somehow, I think all along you knew that.
Right. We knew it, but I had to, like, okay, maybe there's a technology in there that, like, you know, I can't remember when I read the last book about, you know, smoke alarm technologies. I haven't read one lately, but I followed up on it, you know. So it's things like that, or it's like coincidences that happen to me, you know, and people say, no, Raj, that was not a coincidence. You know, it's too much.
Yeah, sometimes
I was in a little town up in Colorado. It's one of these tourist towns north. Well, it's not north of Boulder. It's, I think west of Boulder. I'll think of the name of it. Central City, Colorado.
Mm-hmm.
And I had gone up there with a family member, and we, you know, you kind of do the thing in Central City, but then there's one road that leads out of Central City north of town. And if you go just a short distance, you can pull over, and the whole side of the hill looking up, very steep hill, it's all these old graves, you know, from the 1800s, you know, the Wild West days. So we got out, and we hiked all the way to the grave at the top of the hill, the one that was all the way to the top is this one of those flat graves where it actually looks like a casket made out of cement, you know. And we sat down on this, and when we got there, what was unusual, there was a camera sitting on the grave. And I picked it up, and I looked around. As far as I could see, there's no people. So I thought, you know, I'm not a thief. What am I going to do with this camera? So whoever I was with said, take it. You know, take it home. I'm sure that it's just tourists that come in and out of here, and they're probably long gone, you know. So I took the camera with me. Now, an entire year passes. 1 year later, now I'm in Boulder, Colorado, talking to a friend, talking about what a great time I had up in Central City. And he says, hey, let's go. So I had a really cool Mustang convertible. We put the top down. The two of us jumped in, and we're going up these canyon roads. We're heading to Central City. Beautiful summer day. And there's two guys about our age hitchhiking on the side of the road. So I pulled over. Hey, where are you guys heading? We're heading up to Central City. Get in. You know, they were real happy. Okay. So we're driving up there and, you know, making chit chat. I said, yeah, I haven't been to Central City in about a year. One of the guys in the back seat says, yeah, I haven't been up here in about a year either. It was just about this time of year. Me and my girlfriend went up. And he said, yeah, it was kind of a tragedy, our visit. And I said, why? What happened? He goes, well, we were done with Central City. We went north of town on that little road. We saw the cemetery. We climbed to the top of the hill to the highest grave. And when we got home, my girlfriend realized she left her camera up there.
Oh, goodness.
And now that's just, okay, now that's coincidence, okay?
Yeah.
But when you have like 5,000 of those stories in your life, it's like...
I always say this too, Roger, you know, those little coincidences sometimes are maybe what point us in the direction that we're supposed to be going in life for all we know. I mean, some people prefer to call it synchronicity. Who knows? But listen, I want to get you to tell folks really quickly, because our hour is drawing steadily nigh. Where can they find your work, and where can they find your book?
Okay, the best place for people to go, because I'm also a playwright. I've written and I've been produced on the stages in Chicago, different parts of the country. I specialize in comedy. I've actually directed two full-length films. I've done three documentaries. Some of the stuff is free. You could just download it. Other things, you have to use your credit card and go to different places. But if you go, if people know my name, Roger Marsh, R-O-G-E-R-M-A-R-S-H. Okay, but it's rogermarsh.moonfruit.com. Moonfruit. That is a web building site.
Ah, indeed. I was about to ask.
If you go there, it pretty much, I even have a really cool paranormal short story that they can read. That's actually in the book. I actually embedded that into Sacred Dialogue because it was such a cool book. And if you read the book, that was the story that every morning I was dating my wife at the time, and I read her the next piece of the book.
Uh-huh.
And without taking up too much time on the show, there was a character that I was writing about in the book, and I had named her. And my wife was doing, in the graduate department, she was doing a random survey, and her job in the evenings was to make these phone calls every 50th name in town. And she comes one morning to tell me that that character that I wrote in the book, her name popped up in her survey for that night, and she and I both had the same phone number.
Wow.
Different exchange, but the exact four digits at the end. And the whole story is about synchronicity and those kind of things happening. So it just came full circle, like, oh, my God.
They do tend to happen, though. And that's, I think, your evidence of that, Roger Marsh. And listen, I want to thank you, by the way, my man, for coming on Grayling Report with us. I hope you'll come back at some point in the future. And, of course, you know, we got to stay in touch. There's a lot to do out there. I'll be hoping to hear more from you more frequently, more often.
Okay, I hope so. Thanks so much. I'm very honored to be on the show tonight.
Yeah, it's been our pleasure. Again, I hope you'll come back. Roger Marsh's book, again, Sacred Dialogue, Tuning into Mother Nature's Universal Broadcast Band. I know you're tuned, so we'll expect some updates here maybe in a few weeks. Okay, Roger?
Okay, sounds good. Give me a ring.
Have a great evening, my friend.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
He's a fascinating guy, and of course you are typically going to find fascinating people like that when you tune into a program like this. And I'll tell you this, speaking of fascinating, and this is probably going to be the final word for tonight's broadcast, but there was this story out of Maine. I don't know if any of you guys heard about this. The story goes that apparently people were reporting that they were hearing blood-curdling screams in this particular area. And so the police had to go and investigate, and guess what they found? You may not want to try and guess. Well, I'll tell you anyway. The police investigating these horrific screams in Maine found a happy little pig. And it wasn't screaming at all. Maybe some things aren't quite always what they seem. But I think that with Roger Marsh, we know that things are ultimately entirely what they seem. Fascinating talking with him. Do check out his book, Sacred Dialogue, Tuning into Mother Nature's Universal Broadcast Band. And, of course, we'll have that linked up in the show notes for you just as well. On behalf of all of us here at the Grayling Report, including yours truly, but all the fine folks who helped me make this program what it is on a weekly basis, John Anderson, Caleb Hanks, Matthew Oakley, Dick Oakley, and yours truly, the mouth of the South. I am Micah Hanks, and it is the Grayling Report. We'll talk to you again next week. In the meantime, stay strange, stay warm wherever you may be, and stay tuned. We'll talk to you again soon.
Been listening to the Grayling Report with Micah Hanks. Any rebroadcast or duplication of this program or program content without express written permission is strictly prohibited. The Grayling Report, in direct cooperation with the internet website graylingreport.com.